Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. Welcome to The Round Table. Well, it's been a momentous week in US-Russia relations, and the winner appears to be Russia. The Trump-Putin meeting in Helsinki set off a series of awkward backdowns for the American president. It created confusion amongst his senior officials and fury in the US diplomatic and intelligence community. A former CIA director accused the US president of treason when Donald Trump said he didn't see why Russia would have meddled in the US presidential elections, only to later claim that he meant to say he didn't see why it wouldn't be Russia. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, had to hose down suggestions the US might allow a former ambassador to Russia to be interrogated in Moscow as a sort of quid pro quo for the indictments of Russians accused of election interference in the US. And nobody, inside or outside his administration, appears to know just what was agreed to in the Helsinki meeting, or what the next move is, least of all his own intelligence chief, Dan Coats.
We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
That's the president's intelligence chief there. Now, Donald Trump is caught between making friends with Russia and trying to placate Americans.
Getting along with President Putin, getting along with Russia is a positive, not a negative. Right. Now, with that being said, if that doesn't work out, I'll be the worst enemy he's ever had.
Back in Moscow, President Putin has been spruiking Russia's latest nuclear weapons and highlighting Donald Trump's troubles at home.
We see that there are forces in the United States that are prepared to casually sacrifice Russian-US relations, to sacrifice them for their ambitions in the course of an internal political battle.
President Putin is doing his bit to control the narrative between Moscow and Washington, and is using it to push his objective of restoring Russian power and pride on the world stage. So, at the round table today, we're posing the question, is Vladimir Putin making Russia great again? And if so, how much credit should go to Donald Trump? Joining me to discuss this is Karina Orlova, Washington correspondent for Echo of Moscow Radio, Kyle Wilson, visiting fellow at the ANU Center for European Studies and a former diplomat and senior Russia analyst at the Office of National Assessments, and Mark Edeley, professor of Soviet and Russian history at the University of Melbourne. You all come at this from different backgrounds, so I want to draw on that first by asking you all for your personal reactions to the Helsinki summit and the furor that it's generated in the US. And Karina Orlova, I'd like to start with you. You fled Russia after getting death threats from a Vladimir Putin ally over one of your radio programs. How did you feel, given your history, seeing the US president seeming to defer to President Putin as more trustworthy than his own intelligence service?
Well, believe it or not, but I was literally crying, and I'm not kidding. I was literally crying because what I saw was Donald Trump is giving his country and his people up to Vladimir Putin, and probably selling the country off to him. And he only doubled down later with this stunning story of Michael McFaul and Putin's request, which Trump later disagreed on, which was also amazing. It took the White House 24 hours to produce this shameful disagree answer, and Michael McFaul was shocked, and everyone else was shocked, and Russians only, they seemed to mock the United States. So you probably saw the Russian law enforcement statement that they want more Americans to be interrogated by them, including Kyle Parker, who now works as the chief of staff of the Helsinki Commission within the Senate. So it was something truly shocking. And so for me, I love America. I think it's a great country. Unfortunately, I can't say the same about Russia. So it's a pity that what Donald Trump is doing to this country. And I very much hope that he will be stopped from doing this.
You say that you were actually in tears. I mean, were expat Russians like you hoping that, some people say that the Russian president was in a weak position ahead of this summit. Were you hoping that President Trump would stand up to President Putin?
No, I was not, of course, but I didn't expect that he would do that, that he will say that Russia, that he would not recognize the fact that Russia meddled in the election, and that he would basically give a green light to the Russians to meddle further, and that he would deny his own director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, statements made 3 days prior to that.
Kyle Wilson, you're a former intelligence officer. How do you think you'd react if an Australian Prime Minister did something like this with intelligence you'd given them?
I guess I'd be dumbfounded.
A little like Dan Coats.
Yes, you asked for reaction to Helsinki. You know, Donald Trump is a man who really sort of defeats the English language, and he defeats satire because, you know, he is so extreme. You know, I'm sort of reminded of, I worked in China, and I'm reminded of a famous statement by Mao Zedong, who said to his advisors, "Cut the windy crap. The whole world is turning upside down." And that comes to mind when I watch Donald Trump. And of course, I recall, you know, there was that fusillade of champagne corks popping in the Kremlin when Donald Trump was elected. And it's reliably reported that Mr. Putin, who is, you know, can be very succinct and brief, he said, "It doesn't get better than this." So, you know, for me, it was a kind of farce and rather sad to watch Trump, you know, a man who clearly identifies his own personal interests with the interests of his country, and to see him in the hands of the very formidable, you know, very well trained and acute Vladimir Putin was a kind of pathetic spectacle.
You wear many hats. You're also a diplomat, and you were an interpreter for prime ministers and heads of state. Given the secrecy surrounding this summit, would you have liked to have been an interpreter at that meeting between these two presidents?
Well, that's very interesting you should ask that, because I once interpreted for Vladimir Putin. In fact, I've interpreted for him 3 times, but only once face-to-face. He's not a difficult man to interpret because he keeps it simple, he keeps it short, and he keeps it succinct. But of course, there's always a subtext to what we should never forget, that he's a highly trained former KGB officer. You've asked about the interpretation. There's been some controversy over the interpretation.
There has indeed.
There's been a fair bit of criticism that the unfortunate interpreters, you know, the interpreter can never win. You've either said too much or you've said too little, but there was some misinterpretation. But historically, it didn't matter, of course, because, you know, even the secret meeting was recorded, and there is a recording of it somewhere. But the very idea that a U.S. president would meet a Russian president behind closed doors with only interpreters present is in itself, you know, I think, sort of deeply perturbing. And
you say you know there was misinterpretation?
Oh, no, that's been established, because misinterpretation was at the press conference. We don't know whether there was misinterpretation at the actual secret meeting.
Because no one knows what was said.
Because no one knows what was said. And Putin, of course, you know, he started learning English when he became president of Russia. He already had fluent German. And he's done pretty well. He speaks, you know, quite respectable English. So Putin would have a pretty fair idea of what Trump was saying to him. Trump would be wholly dependent on his interpreter to understand what Putin was saying to him.
Mark Eadley, let me bring you in now. You bring a broad historical perspective to our discussion. How would you rate this meeting of the two leaders? Do you think it will end up having long-term significance?
Well, that remains to be seen, given that Trump seems to say one thing one day and then a completely other thing the next. I mean, at that famous press conference, a Russian journalist asked him about having just, you know, days before, when he was in the West and talking to NATO and berating the allies, and he had called Russia a foe, and he was asked about this, and he said, oh, no, I didn't call it a foe. I called it a competitor, which was simply untrue, right? He did call it a foe. He did also call the EU a foe as well. So, and then, you know, he flies back to Washington. His advisors sit him down and tell him that he might be in some serious trouble. And then he tries to walk back all of these statements. So that's the one, I think, from a Russian perspective, that the problem they're facing is that this president is pretty unpredictable in what he's doing. And he seems to like to speak off the cuff and tweet and so on. And only occasionally listen to his advisors. On the other hand, too, what we should probably not forget is that this is an administration which is remarkably tough on Russia. It is under President Trump that Ukraine has received lethal weapons to defend itself. Of course, a lot of this is not necessarily the doing of the president, right? But we have, on the one hand, we have this contradictory situation where you have apparently pro-Putin president because he seems to like strong men, right, Trump? And on the other hand, you have an administration which has not been particularly pro-Russian. And what exactly is going on there, we also, I think, do not know.
Let me throw a question to you all, actually, about that. It's a little, let me quote Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer, who queried whether the US president was, quote, putting the interests of Russia over those of the US because Putin had something over him. Now, do you, let me put this question first to you, Mark Eadley, but to all of you, do you think it's possible that Vladimir Putin does have some embarrassing information that he's using as leverage over Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's pretty possible. I'm not sure if we know that they do, but this is the kind of stuff. I mean, you know, Trump is a man who has a history of sexual misbehavior, and you know, he clearly enjoyed himself in Moscow, so it's not unlikely that there's something. I'm not sure if this is not overstressed in many ways because he has weathered so many storms of sexual nature that if it were some sort of sexual compromise they would have, he would probably get away with that anyway. But there's also the question of his finances and how he went from being bankrupt to being a very successful businessman through real estate deals, which do seem to involve a lot of Russian investors. So there might be something else there that is much more problematic. But I mean, overall, I don't think it's unthinkable that all sorts of things could be held over him.
What do you think of that, Karina Orlova? Is that something that you discuss amongst the people you know in Russia?
Oh, no, I actually don't. I also think that it doesn't matter anymore if Putin has or doesn't have anything on Trump, because after Monday, we could see that Donald Trump has given up his nation's interests. So it doesn't matter why he did this. He just did. And also some argue that, you know, there's just this tactics that and this is Trump's worldview. And it's not that Putin has something on him. But I'd like to point out that Yes, that is his tactics of intimidation and blackmailing, you know, and frightening everything, all of that he did to the European Union, to NATO, to Kim, by the way. So one day he was sending, he was blowing kisses to Kim. The other day he was calling him a fat rocket man and so on. But he has never done anything like that to Vladimir Putin, never, ever, never said or done anything. So I would be be alarmed here. And also to the point that a PP tape, let's say this, would not compromise Donald Trump because there is nothing can compromise this man anymore. Yeah, it seems like true, but at the same time, Donald Trump prefers to stay really discreet on his sexual affairs. So he paid to Stormy Daniels, he paid to this Playboy, former Playboy model. So he, for some reason, we don't know what exact reasons, but he prefers to hide this, right? So probably it matters for him.
Just briefly on the point that you say that Trump has pretty much given up to President Putin. I mean, the argument the president would make is that strategically he's taking a long view by not antagonizing the Russian president, saying that he wants to build better relations in order to deal with the really big issue of the nuclear danger. Do you not give him any credit for that?
No, I don't, because why would the United States do that? Because the United States is on the strong side, and Russia doesn't. Russia is a very weak country. Yes, it's a nuclear power, the same as China is, but that's not what that's. You don't use that approach when you deal with Russia, and actually, so yeah.
Kyle Wilson, just to bring you back in on that question of whether you think that the Russian president does have some leverage over the US president.
Well, I can recommend that your listeners read the book by Luke Harding, who was the Guardian's correspondent in Moscow for about 5 years under Putin. He's written a book called Collusion, which tries to bring together, and I think does so pretty effectively, what the evidence is of the relationship, the details of the relationship between Trump and Russia. Of course, it goes back to 1987, and there's no doubt that Russian money was very significant in funding Donald Trump during the 1990s. But look, I'd like to agree with Karina that whether or not the Russians have kompromat on Donald Trump, I think is probably not the main point. Because we've agreed that, you know, Trump is a man who identifies his own interests with those of his country. Only 4% of Washington voted for Trump. He calls it the swamp. It's pretty clear that he is trying to fundamentally remake the American political system. So in that sense, you know, his interests and Putin's interests are congruent. And I think Karine is quite right. It is remarkable that this man, you know, who is so ready to throw dung around at everyone possible, you know, has never, ever said a critical word about Vladimir Putin. I really find that, you know, quite remarkable. And just on the swamp, the word around is that the State Department wasn't even consulted about the meeting in Helsinki. You know, you have a kind of dual power in Washington. You have the White House and you have the rest. I mean, 2 years later, we still don't have an ambassador in Australia. So it's a bizarre situation. But it seems to me the gist of the matter is that Trump and Putin's interests, they perceive them as coinciding.
Karina, you've been reporting on all this from Washington, from the
yes.
swamp, as Trump called it, for Russian radio. How are Russians viewing their leader's performance? I mean, has the summit been an unequivocal success for President Putin and his goal of burnishing that image of Russia as a great power?
Well, yes, it is a success for Vladimir Putin. Even I can agree with that. But it's not a success for Russia because, and you know, Russians know that. They can see that the Republicans in Congress, they are too coward to confront Donald Trump directly and personally. They are too coward to criticize him personally. But they have their anger, right? Because Republicans have historically been hawkish on Russia. So they have their anger over what happened in Helsinki. And their anger transforms into the anger to Russia, on Russia. So what they did, they renewed their attempts to push this bill, which is called the Detour Act, a bipartisan bill introduced by Senators Marco Rubio and Chris Van Hollen. This bill would impose sanctions on Russia in case of meddling. So it's enough to just establish the fact of meddling. So essentially, the word of the director of national intelligence is enough. It's a good bill. It would impose very, very strict sanctions on Russia, and Russia would suffer from it a lot. Also, another senator, a Republican one, by the way, proposed. He promises to introduce a bill that would recognize Russia as state sponsor of terrorism, which is, you know, quite a remarkable bill. And also, there are some Republicans want to amend the CATSA, this famous bill that was passed almost unanimously last year, that imposed those that made the Treasury and the White House impose sanctions on Russia. So personally, Vladimir Putin won on that summit, but Russia, I don't think so.
Mark Ely, what's your sense? I mean, to what extent has this summit helped President Putin push his agenda? And you know, how different is Russia? How differently is it viewed on the world stage now compared to when he assumed the presidency first in 2000?
Well, I agree that this was a remarkable diplomatic success for Putin. He clearly was the more competent, the stronger, and the man in charge. And by and large, this has been, I mean, the making Russia great again on the international scene, right? That has been, in many ways, the strategy of the Putin government since the economic strategy of creating domestic peace through economic growth has stalled basically since about 2013. So the general attempt is to use foreign policy and feelings of Russian nationalism and Russian national pride to shore up support for this government. The problem is that at the same time he's facing some very strong domestic problems. In particular, I mean, there's simply the international politics he is running. A very expensive war in Syria. The annexation of Crimea is incredibly expensive. And of course, the sanctions also do not help the Russian economy. So there's a real fiscal problem, and he's a fairly fiscally conservative president. He's trying to control government spending. But the only thing that can then be controlled is any domestic expenditure. If you continue to spend on the military and on expensive foreign policy pursuits, and the big debate in Russia at the moment, and the debate which has cost him approval ratings quite significantly, is pension reform, where essentially they're trying to lift the pension age to, for men, the life expectancy. So basically, they're trying to deal with the expense of a pension system by making it unattainable for most people because they will die before they reach pension age.
Yes, Karina, you've written about that pensions policy. It was announced during the World Cup. That's fairly strategic. And you've written that even so, it led to the biggest fall ever in Putin's popularity. Did the Helsinki summit help reverse that drop?
Oh, well, I don't know. We don't have new polls yet, but I just want to say that yesterday the Duma passed this law, the pension reform law. So it's over now. And Vladimir Putin first time commented on that. He said that, well, I disagree with that. But then he provided all possible reasons why this reform needs to be done. So it's over. He's won again.
If I can bring you in here, Kyle Wilson, I mean, if in terms of, obviously there are serious economic problems, but in terms of global power, Russia is certainly flexing its muscles. I mean, do you think that Russia is now a power to be feared, for example, by NATO? I mean, should we assume that certainly after this summit, Putin will take some strength from that and perhaps be more militarily aggressive?
Putin likes to spring surprises, of course. If I could just endorse what Mark and Karina said, I think they're very much on the money, as it were. But look, in terms of Putin and greatness, you know, there's a sort of Greek chorus behind Vladimir Putin, which is the Russian parliament, the Duma. And it was very quick, as it were, to speak in quite lurid terms about, you know, what Putin had achieved in Helsinki. There's a very significant statement by one of its senior members, Mr. Pushkov, who said after Helsinki that Russia is again deciding the fate of the planet. I thought that was very revealing because, you know, the fundamental question we're asking here is Russia great again? You've asked that. Well, you know, it seems to me this is very much in the eye of the beholder. Certainly for Russians, Putin has made Russia great again. Karina could tell you that there is, although Russia is increasingly authoritarian, there is one reliable public opinion survey outfit. It's called the Levada Center. Not long ago, it carried out a survey of 1,600 Russians, asked them to name the 20 most outstanding figures in global history. That's 1,600 Russians across 48 provinces. And Stalin came in first with 38%, and Putin came in second on 34%.
You're sounding surprised.
So 34% of Russians believe that Mr. Putin was the second greatest figure in history. So I think we can say that a majority of Russians certainly see Mr. Putin as a very great man indeed, and that he has returned Russia to greatness. Then, of course, you come to the question of, well, how do you define greatness? Now, you know, in Mr. Putin and his propaganda apparatus defines it very much in terms of Russia's glorious martial traditions. Russia is a great military power. You might recall at his inauguration speech he unveiled this whole phalanx of new weapons, which he said made Russia invulnerable. But, you know, for those countries, smaller countries on Russia's western and southern periphery, greatness probably means fear. It seems to me that they have ample reason to feel anxious about Russia, and you've put that question. I would have thought it's very unlikely that Mr. Putin is going to do any more military adventures now. I mean, he's used military force three times to change borders in Europe: Georgia, Crimea, East Ukraine. And of course, he's now involved in Syria, which is the first time Russia's gone abroad militarily since Afghanistan. But at the present time, what is his major goal? His major goal must be to keep Donald Trump in power. So I would have thought he will try to avoid doing anything which might undermine Donald Trump and, as it were, give ammunition to Donald Trump's enemies.
Karina, all over, I want to bring you in on Crimea. I mean, should we see that situation there as Russia defending against NATO expansion, or a sign of a more aggressive tendency that the rest of Europe does need to fear?
So some say that he had this plan a long time ago, but I tend to agree with Ambassador Michael McFaul, and he's written a great book, and I listened to him in the German Marshall Phone in Washington, D.C. in his presentation, so where he basically said that the revolution, the Maidan in Ukraine, made Vladimir Putin make this decision. And I tend to agree with that. I think Vladimir Putin really got scared about Americans, you know, financing revolutions all over the world. And he was certainly scared by the Arab Spring, by the Gaddafi death. And so I think he just didn't want to fall next. I don't think that we should fear for Vladimir Putin annexing parts of Estonia or Baltics countries because they are members of NATO. But I don't know, so I wouldn't speculate on that. But I would say this, until Russia is deterred, and sanctions is a really effective way of deterrence. And Russia as a country and Putin's oligarchs, they do suffer from sanctions, from American sanctions. And there needs to be more sanctions imposed on Russia. And as you know, and it's really effective. So until sanctions keep being imposed, we are fine. So Russia just, you know, needs to be deterred. As to just a small remark on Mr. Pushkov's notes, right? His comments on Russia deciding on the world's fate again. So if he was referring to Russia's meddling in the U.S. elections, then yes, I would agree with him. Otherwise, no, Russia is not deciding on the world's fate.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks to my guests, Karina Allover, Washington correspondent for Echo of Moscow Radio, Kyle Wilson, visiting fellow at the ANU Center for European Studies, and a former diplomat and senior Russia analyst at the Office of National Assessments, and Mark Edley, professor of Soviet and Russian history at the University of Melbourne. I'm Eleanor Hall. Thanks for joining me at the Round Table.